Iran, and perhaps the same is true of for Iran in understanding the American presidency. For instance, on the American side, Meg Greenfield, in a column in the Washington Post of March 12, 1990, said the following: "There are other countries around the world whose thoughts and ways should be harder for us to understand, being more exotic, more alien to our own culture. And there are other countries where over the years we've had far fewer observers in place and far more limited access to information. Yet, even in the time of our relative advantage in Iran, when there was a pretty huge contingent of U.S. nationals in the country, there was never a place where we seemed so repeatedly to get it wrong. Yes, there have been some very good American ambassadors in Tehran, and no, not every American governmental person involved with the country was a washout, far from it. There have been plenty of smart ones who did accomplish good things. But the fact remains that we have this pattern of falling for it in relation to Iran, of not understanding either what was coming or what it meant, of recurrently being had." And then she goes on to recite some of the examples of misunderstandings and miscommunication and so on. But the other side of the equation, I suppose, is people in Iran understanding American institutions and American society and American public reaction. And since our main interest is in the American presidency, why, we naturally wonder to what extent there is an understanding or how people understand and perceive the presidency in your country.
Yeah.
So if you would comment a little on that, it would be helpful.
Well, the for cultures not understanding each other, it's normal.
Yeah.
Always has been the case. But maybe for Iranians not to understand other cultures, it would be a bit strange. And the reason is that they are known as being adaptive people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We have Herodotus who says, if I can remember the Latin phrase correctly, persus imitos, something like that. The Persians love to imitate. Mm-hmm. In other words, they've always been interested in outside world.
Right.
And we have had in our past history many occasions where we got freely from other cultures, and I think one gets from other cultures when one understands it. So we have had understanding, but now you cannot make the same observation. I guess if Herodotus was alive, he wouldn't make the same observation today.
Mm-hmm.
Something has happened,
right,
during the past couple of centuries that really has changed the equation, it seems to me. So with that in mind, and with that introduction in mind, let me say that I like to comment on this American president's scene from abroad on actually two levels. In one level, you have really the image of a president, image of a foreign leader, or image of a foreign government in, let's say, country A or country B.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one level that one has to address. And then second, you have this level of perception or understanding. I really think we should distinguish between the two first.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, regardless of people's level of studying, level of thinking about, level of contemplating, people form images, people form, visions of different things.
What Lippmann called pictures in their minds.
That's right.
Pseudo-reality, pseudo.
Well, sometimes it may be based on reality, sometimes it may be based on fiction, but what kind of image do they have?
Yeah.
So let me address in those two levels. First, we talk about the image. There is an Arabic proverb which says, people follow the religion of their king. So in other words, maybe the images that the governments or the statesmen or the people in the government have of a particular foreign country may in fact affect the kind of image that exists in the between the two nations and so forth. In other words, what kind of image people have had from American presidents or Americans in general first may have to do of what kind of image existed in the government. And again, I'm emphasizing, I get to the perception and understanding later. American, in their dealing with Iran, have, I guess, experienced a variety of phases. So therefore, maybe I just in passing refer to various phases or various periods of history that of the relationship of the two countries. For that, just in passing, our relationship with the U.S. Has begun sometimes in mid-19th century, and we first had commercial contract, I think, in 1840s, mm-hmm. 1846 or 1845. And then the diplomatic relations between the two countries apparently started in 1882. Uh-huh. And it's interesting that the first Iranian ambassador in Washington used to be called Mr. Washington. Mm. In Tehran, still in history, there is a Mr. Washington. And in fact, the television had a series recently on it about the life of Mr. Washington. The title of it was Mr. Washington. That's what he is, I guess. Mm. Let's say in going back to Adam Watson's book on the expansion of the international system, this universalization of European system in World War II has really incorporated everybody into this dealing and willing, although even if they didn't have bilateral relations. So let's just take from the beginning of the century. The period of World War I, and right, we were in the middle of a revolution, I guess. The kind of image we had from this society was formed by people like Morgan Schuster, for example, who was a businessman from Princeton. And he was dispatched there to put our economic house in order. And then the kind of image we had from this society was formed by a young teacher, again from East, called Baskerville, who in fact got shot during the revolution, and he was known as the hero of the revolution. Still in the local, they know him as a hero. He was a teacher stationed in Tabriz. And then during the revolutionary, he took the side of the revolutionaries and he got killed there. The kind of image we had from this society is formed by somebody like Arthur Melspaugh, who came again, put our economic house in order.
And at the invitation of the...
At the invitation of the Iranian government. And of course, Morgan Schuster's had to leave the country because of Russian ultimatum. They didn't like the kind of work he was doing. The man was a hard-working man and was really helping to put the economic house in order. So we didn't distinguish between the president and the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. So we would look at U.S. as one unit, and of course people like him were the representative. Then you have World War II, and the Americans were the third hero, the third force, which was really a hero. In other words, being stuck between the two superpowers of the Russia and Great Britain, here is a third power from far away, who has no colonial interest and who are here to save us and help us and so forth. And they did so. And the Americans did help us to get the Russians out of Iran and so forth. So you can see the kind of image they have, and of course it's included the image of the president. After all, the president has signed their dispatch order to come to Iran and so forth. Or the president has given the okay for the, let's say, pressure on the Soviet Union to get out of Iran and so forth. But then all of a sudden the images start to change. and we are affected by the Cold War. And during the 50s and the coup d'etat that we had. So you had this mixed image. On the one hand, they don't know what to do with this country, which has always been a hero, which the president of the United States has always been the champion of democracy and champion of this and champion of that. And all of a sudden now, they are the people who order the coup d'etat and so forth. Mm. So you have a different image. Then you get the let's say the 60s and Kennedy, and surprisingly enough, all of a sudden, I think maybe Kennedy is the most popular American president in Iran.
Yes, yes.
A lot of his pictures were sold with his family. In fact, the small rugs were all weaved with his picture on them. And he being the champion of the poor and champion of the helping the poor people and so forth. Was it because he had a hand in what was then economic changes or economic reform was taking place in Iran and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe so. During the 70s, the image of American society in general was the ideal place to go. That's why during the 70s we had thousands and thousands of people rushing to school here and going to school here and getting educated.
Mostly education, not yet a lot of trade or.
Well, there were some trades as well, a lot of trades, and but this was the place that you deal with both in terms of education, economy, and so forth and so on. Then you have the 1980s, that shall we call it the tarnished image? That's the image all tarnished because of the revolution. And you get the mixed feeling. And it's really interesting now, the feeling that on the one level they are the image of the imperialist, the image of the great Satan, and of course the American president being the leader of this great Satan. And on the other hand, you have this image of the United States as the most powerful and the most advanced society that human history has ever witnessed. Mm. So you have this mixed feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this image may have something rooted in the realities, or maybe even formed by you. Shall we say propaganda, shall we say communication, mass communication, and so forth and so on. But to me, or the way I think about the images of this society, this is the way I see it during the past, as I guess 60, 70 years. But then we have to now become more specific and say what kind of perception do we have about, let's say, an American president.
The second level.
The second level, or the level of perception, the level of understanding. Mm-hmm. There, I think I will preface by this famous line from this Iranian mystic who says, "Everyone who wants to see me through his own eyes. Nobody tries to see me as I am." Mm. Now, here, I think the catch word is really seeing other persons through one's own image and one's own, I guess, mind.
Yeah.
In that sense, we should say, we should distinguish between the government officials or the way they perceive the American president or American society, and then the elite. The intellectual elite or the educated class and so forth and so on. On the government side, we have had during the past 60, 70 years three different governments, distinctly. One, the royalist or the monarchy. The other one is the short period of the nationalist, and then the revolutionary. Each one of these people have their own image. It is really interesting and it's really funny that the monarchs, or the monarch, the two, both father and son, the monarchs looked at the American president as a monarchical president.
Mm. Mm.
And they really assume that the American president has the same kind of leverage that they do have as a king. For example, when apparently in 1930s, Baltimore Sun, or the newspaper in Baltimore, the newspaper in Baltimore had a piece on Shaw's father and telling him that he was an uneducated villager and so forth. When they portrayed him in the newspaper as a villager without any education, they got very upset and they complained to the American president and say, why don't you stop the newspapers? Thinking that the American president in fact has the same prerogative as a king does and just decrees for the newspaper to close down. And so did the Shah. And that sometimes when the American press had something against him, it would directly go to the White House and expect the White House to just give a decree and have the newspaper shut down. But I think the most fascinating account is that in one of Shaw's book, when he's talking about Roosevelt, and he says, you know, something strange happened. When I was in Washington, we were talking, he told me that he knew a lot about our woods in the northern part of Iran. We have lots of woods. And he knew a lot about all that, and apparently he was interested in woods. And you know, it's strange that the President of the United States shown interest in coming to Iran and work in those woods after his term is over. It's unbelievable for a president to think that way.
Who is that? Which president again?
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt did.
Well, he was interested in farming and all that.
Sure.
So in other words, the royalist, the king, thought definitely the president of the United States should be like a king. How could a king be prepared to go to another country and work? It's unheard of.
Yeah.
It's unimagined. So in other words, on the level of really. On the level that we expect some sort of understanding, some sort of more sophisticated perception, here people see through their own eyes.
Right.
And since the king can decree, so should the American president.
Yeah.
Well, that's in one level. Then you have the other government, the nationalist government, which was a short period. They did not really didn't portray, let's say, general image of the American president, other than saying the president he had to deal with was, which was Mossadegh, was Truman, and he expected Truman to, of course, being to help him and so forth and so on with our fight with Great Britain. Then you have the revolution.
The date of the revolution is.
1979. Yeah. Then you have the third government, which is the revolutionary people. It's very hard to say what kind of feeling they have. Very simplistically, I thought that the American president can do a great deal. So then that's why all these slogans saying death to this, death to that, thinking that by saying death to Carter, everything is solved. This is on the level of popular. But on the other hand, it seems to me that there is some sort of sophistication because, for example, in dealing with the hostages story, they all said, you can never finish the hostages story with Carter, for example. He's too weak. So apparently they knew that the president cannot maneuver all the time, or it has something to do with the individual of the person. And they all felt that they could deal with somebody like Reagan far better, easier, I guess. That's why the hostage story in the end was solved with Reagan.
You think it was a rational act rather than... Meg Greenfield describes it as extreme cruelty. This is her words about this. The Ayatollah taunted and tormented Carter down to the last little vengeance of not letting the embassy hostages be released until the clock had run by just minutes on Carter's presidency. You would have thought the Reagan people would have gotten the idea by then But when new hostages had been seized by the Shah's shadowy Iran-connected group that had been holding them, the gruesome saga started all over again. But that's a different version.
No, I don't think it's really that simplistic. I don't think it's a really personal grudge.
Mm-hmm.
My point is this, that the royalist had one image mm-hmm. of the president be a king.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be having a more sophisticated mm-hmm. perception of the president.
Yeah.
They distinguish. Right? It's not that all presidents are the same or all can do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to me, maybe it was really a cost-effect analysis of saying mm-hmm. Carter is leaving the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we start to deal with the president who is going to be in the office? So in one level you can say it was very calculated. On another level, you can say they had the same misunderstanding that if Carter goes, the new president will not honor the word of the past one.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe all of that came to their head. But my point is that these people seems to have a more sophisticated version of the American government and American society in general.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe I should say why I think that that is the case.
Yeah.
It seems to me, for example, that the elite, or let's say the people who were officials of the government during the Shah's regime, were basically from rich family,
mm.
who would take fellowship and come directly to Harvard, Princeton, here and there and the other. And then they would receive their money from home and they would go to school and they had no worries. So they really never got into the real life, real America, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the elite now in power are really ordinary people. They are from ordinary families who came to this country during the late 60s and early 70s. And to be honest, most of them had to work.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them may even had to work illegally.
Mm-hmm.
Immigration officer, you're not allowed to work, but if you need low paid jobs and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having to work in low paid job has disadvantages, but on the other hand has the great advantage of allowing you to see real America, mm-hmm. talk to them. You're not just seeing the elite in Princeton or in Harvard and so on.
Man in the street.
Yeah, you see the man in the street and you get a touch of that this society is very sophisticated and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least the way I see it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So on the level of government, I just summarize it, on the level of government, I would say the royalists thought of the president as a king, and they expected him to behave like a king. And that's why, when you look at the record, the Iranian government always expected the president to order this or to order that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they didn't quite understand why wouldn't, although let's say Nixon has given the carte blanche for the Shah to buy anything, and yet still he has to lobby and so on. They wouldn't understand what's going on. He has given the order,
yeah.
and so forth. It was only, I think, late 70s that they got some sort of complex perception of what's going on in American society. So during the revolution, the revolutionary people, on one level, they seem to have a very sophisticated understanding of what's going on here. But then, unfortunately, the leading people at the top are those religious leaders who have never been abroad.
Yeah.
And therefore, if I talk very sophisticatedly about the United States, immediately it's seen as somebody who's pro-American or this and that and the other. So it's really a mixed perception of what's going on here. If you get rid of Reagan, everything will be solved. But now, having the experience of Reagan going and Bush coming, and nothing was solved and so on and so forth. So they are beginning to get this complicated perception. But then this is the government.
Yeah.
But on the level of elites and let's say more educated people in Iran, I think the unfortunate part is that our intellectuals have very greatly been affected by Stalinism in many ways, and since 60s by New Left.
Mm.
To be intellectual, you have to be You have to read leftist literature. Mm-hmm. You will be surprised, for example, to see that what is the rise to globalism?
Mm-hmm. Stephen Ambrose.
Stephen Ambrose. It's been translated for about 10 years now, and it goes like hotcake. Mm. Or what is this? I forgot the name of the book. It's about the Council of Foreign Relations in New York. There's a book on Council of Foreign Relations, give a history of Council of Foreign Relations and so on. It's now translated into Persian as the mind of the imperial, the mind of Rostam Aksoy Imperatory, the company which is really the mind of the American imperial government. So they are very much into, or the work of this linguist, the famous linguist Chomsky.
Chomsky. Mm.
Chomsky's work goes like hotcake. Mm.
Among the elite.
Among the elite, among the educated, among the intellectuals and so
but
on.
But not so, among government officials.
Well, not really. Some of us, let's say, who teach at the university, pay attention to those, and some of us argue. For example, I, for one, argued at one point when the Ambrose book was brought to the class, and people wanted us to discuss, or this book about Council of Foreign Relations. I said, listen, the council may have had an influence in the government, may have had an important role to play in formulating some of the policies, but it's far from being the mind of the imperial government. And that in itself is contradiction in terms to begin with. And also, in the United States, it is the play, it's really a game of influence, politics, lobbying, and so on and so forth. So they might have had influence within the government at one point in their history, mm-hmm. but no longer.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this is a legacy of a Stalinist literature, which were really the vanguard of intellectuals in Iran during the 40s and 50s, still continues, of course, in the form of New Left.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever book translated from the left goes like hotcakes.
But it has to be translated.
Sure, it has to be in Persian, though.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, on the one level, we can say, well, there is a simple image, but of this great Satan, but that's far from the whole view.
Mm-hmm.
It's more sophisticated images running around in Tehran about the American president, about the American society. But one dissertation I saw in Tehran University, for example, done on American presidency,
oh.
and it's called American President. Mm. But I was looking for some sort of position as to how does he see it, but I saw that it's really more affected by legalism,
yeah.
using Hans Morgenthau's.
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe that's the problem we have with politics in Iran in general, that political science and politics is very much influenced by this legal approach to understand.
Where did that come from originally?
French, I think. French. I think, we first, when political science was set up in Tehran, it was all French educated, so it's
mm-hmm.
a legal approach to sin.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a political science is called Hulga Siyasi, meaning political law,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah.
The field of politics is usually referred to as, oh, I said, what did you study? I said, the politics. Oh, you mean political law. I said, what does mm-hmm. that mean? I don't know. So it's really, when I saw the dissertation, I was very excited. Say, let me see.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked through it, and it was really more trying to present the American president as a legal institution, or let's say look at its place in the American system in general
mm-hmm.
through the legal eyes and the legality of it and how far it can go. And that. But on the other hand, you can say it showed that there are some people who are interested to understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then another thing is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has set up this college. It's called College of International Relations.
Mm.
A lot of students, they are really set up to train diplomats. And I offer a couple of courses there. They are very much interested to know what's going on here. And they ask serious questions about American president and American elites and American society and so forth. And they question some of those new left literature on American presidency. In other words, the new left seems to portray American president, as the vanguard of economic interests of the big companies.
Mouthpiece for the companies.
Mouthpiece for the big companies and so on. Well, after all, he can't be there unless they all consent to his appointment. And of course, they can control the media. And it's really an appointment through the mass campaign over the media and getting people to vote and so forth and so on. There are a lot of people who are now questioning that. With this little pep talk, now you can just address a question in mind.
Yeah. Where does the questioning come from? Where would you? Who are the people that are challenging or addressing another, trying to make people think of another way of viewing the presidency?
Well, I think it has something to do with the revolution itself. In other words, the revolution has made people to think seriously about what happened.
Mm-hmm.
See, everybody thought they were going to have a revolution and the revolution is a magic. Now they are going to create heaven.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't work. It didn't bring heaven. So now they are questioning what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are asking questions, what does it mean? Let's say, I guess I left out a group of people which are not really important, namely the old people.
Mm-hmm.
The previous generation, anything happened, they would say, British did it.
Mm-hmm.
Now the one who are now 60s, 55, 60 years old, everything is on the hand of the CIA and so forth. Whereas the youth are now beginning to say, it's not that simple. The Americans do not have buttons, just push it.
Mm-hmm.
One interesting comment about the American presidency and American government, in fact, came from Rafsanjani, surprisingly. When this McFarlane episode was over, and one Friday, when he was giving this Friday prayer sermon, he said, you know, if McFarlane episode doesn't teach us much, at least it gives us one channel through American government. It is a sign that there are not a bunch of genius sitting in Washington deciding, just like human like us, making mistakes, and making blunders, the big blunders like this. So you should see McFarlane episode in this light.
That's very
to me, it was really interesting. It was a sign of the degree of sophistication, that governments are not holistic, that there is one voice and so forth and so on. So maybe really what I'm saying is that we have not looked at US so seriously as to distinguish between one particular corner of American society, namely the presidency, as opposed to the other.
Right.
So we look at it in general as a government and see it that way. And one has to really look through those messy comments about the United States in general to pick up something about the presidency. And this, for example, is an example. Now we thought that the President of the United States has a bunch of genius around him in the basement of the White House and helping him make decisions. Now this McFarlane shows that, no, it's not the case.
That's good. Are there any other countries in the region that have intellectuals who influence and feed in ideas? Are there channels in that way for thinking? I think I'll close that a minute.
Sure.
Channels for feeding in more recent conceptions.
Well, I'll come to this question, but I said that when you asked what are the factors involved in this, I said one is the revolution.
Yeah.
So in other words, there might be other. So let me enumerate those, and then I'll come back to the question. In other words, the revolution has helped serious questions to be raised,
mm-hmm.
not only about American society, not only about politics, but everything.
Mm-hmm.
And people ask serious questions about their own history,
mm-hmm.
their own background, what has happened to them, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have some, let's say, sophisticated people who have been educated abroad, who has come back.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you now, who comes back? The one who really cares about his society.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not economically booming. Let's say people, it's not like the Arab states in the region.
Saudi Arabia,
Kuwait, Qatar, who gives high salary for people to run there. Mm-hmm. So it's those who run back home to Iran, those Iranian educated who run back home, invariably, they do so because they care about their society.
Mm-hmm.
They may be few, but they are very effective. I have seen, for example, one student of Rozanov, for example,
mm-hmm.
who got a PhD with Rozanov, came back from USC.
Mm-hmm.
And he raises serious questions in some
mm-hmm.
of his classes and makes people to raise serious questions.
Mm-hmm.
Your student is there raising serious questions and so forth. There is a student who came back recently from American University,
mm-hmm.
Who I have seen raising serious questions and so
mm-hmm.
forth. So there are a new breed of intellectuals
mm-hmm.
who don't run back in Iran because there is job available and opportunity available, because after all the economy is not that booming, and
mm-hmm.
also the government doesn't seem very inviting.
Right.
So these people really have serious concern. That's why they go, and therefore they are raising serious questions.
Are there?
And
you go ahead.
And then the third factor, I think, which one cannot deny, is mass communication.
Yeah.
It's enormous. See, let's say 20 years ago, you could hardly pick up a BBC broadcasting easily, unless you had a giant radio. Now with a small transistor, you can pick up BBC, Voice of America, or other radios.
Mm.
And so they raise undermining questions. They, of course, raise questions because of their own interest. Voice of America doesn't care what would happen to me. Follow American interest. So does BBC. And so does Radio Israel. But by doing so, by raising serious questions, they make people ask serious questions. So to me, they may be the three overriding factors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to your question about the intellectual trends from the region, with the risk of becoming very chauvinistic,
mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's always the other way around. It has been Iran which has really given current of thinking to the whole region.
Mm-hmm.
I have to confess, though, that the Arab state seems to be doing extremely well in terms of economy, in terms of sophisticated financial system, banking system, communication
mm-hmm.
system, and so forth. But I don't think they have really been created or written a book or presented an essay which has really come to a breakthrough. No essay like this, which is the end of history essay here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What's his name? I forgot his name.
Francis Fukuyama.
Fukuyama.
I wrote a long piece.
That's right, on the end of history. I've heard about it.
Yeah.
No, essay like that which really make a sweeping breakthrough and create hot debates and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
We are the one who have always set the agenda, it seems to me, in the region. But who knows, maybe in the future the reverse will be true. But so far, not really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there a course given on the presidency in any Iranian
No, there is
university?
A course called American Political System,
mm-hmm.
and there is a course American Foreign Policy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in those, so there are two courses distinctly devoted to America, to American government and American polity.
And you've given courses on American government yourself.
Yes, I did. I did and tried to see if I can cover. I tried to take a very sophisticated approach, and I tried to tailor the course in their own mind frame, not here. Mm-hmm. If I teach that course here, it would maybe different. I approach it differently, but there I approach it very differently.
What would be an example of the difference?
For example, I may not spend a great deal of time here if I were to offer the course in the U.S. on relation between religion and politics.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to. It's apparently clear to everybody, although I think it's needed for here too.
Mm-hmm.
But there I spend a great deal of time showing what role religion plays in this society and how it has a proper function to play. I spend a great deal of money. I spend a great deal of time on where the money comes for the American government.
And campaign expenses.
Well, no, not that. And see where the budget comes.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that you may say why that, because I can explain to them that's why American president cannot be a king,
mm-hmm.
because he's paid by the people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas let's say in our own case, the government doesn't get paid by the people,
mm-hmm.
because all the oil reserve belongs to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the curse for us, because the government doesn't feel obligated to the people because it doesn't need people's money.
Mm.
In fact, government is distributing money.
Mm.
So they can act like a king, whereas American president cannot, because if people do not pay taxes, he can't even pay for his bureaucrat.
Mm.
Mm. So I spent some time in that I may not have to do it if I teach the course here.
Yeah.
But there are these kind of differences and stuff.
Does an idea in the American system like checks and balances have any corollary in Iran?
Since the idea for both society came from European philosophers,
mm-hmm.
Let's say Locke and Montesquieu and so forth,
mm-hmm.
Definitely there is in fact talk about distinction between the different branches and so forth and so on. It's part of the constitution.
Yeah.
Not the way it is presented here. But I think in both regime, in both political system, you can see the sign of this. And the main reason is that they both come from Europe.
What about an institution like a press conference? Rafsanjani has press conferences, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. This press conference business is very new in Iran in many ways. But then Shah used to have press conferences as well. But another topic which I spent some time on, let's say in the American course on American government, is accountability. And I think press conference is partly grows out of that accountability.
Sure, absolutely.
Now, how much the Iranian government feel accountable to the people, how much they feel accountable to the people is really the way of explaining why they have press conferences and whether they have it or not. It seems to me that they feel that the revolution has been brought to the fore by the people, so therefore they should explain something to the people, and therefore press conference is a way of explaining. But in Iranian case, it basically has been an occasion where more foreign press are available.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that seems to be more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that a way of giving a message without being burned?
Mm-hmm.
Because invariably during the past 10 years they have had a a mediator or a messenger, they got burned for it. So therefore, maybe it's a way of giving message rather than giving press conference. So a press conference is used for a different reason than a press conference itself as function of a government.
Right. Is the international press well represented in Iran?
I cannot really give you the exact the information that I need.
What about the connection between political parties and the presidency? Is that the idea of the president as party leader? Is that analogous in any way with Iranian political arrangements?
Well, but first of all, let me say this: that there are this view in Iran that the American president is really not a party person.
Mm-hmm.
That is understood.
Mm-hmm.
There is this. In other words, the fact that the American party system is not a party system the way the Europeans are is relatively understood in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, he doesn't seem as a party person. And that's maybe, in fact, part of the reason that he's seen, or he's liked to be seen as a royal president or as a head of the company.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's also the effect of the leftist, or the new left school of interpretation of international relations, that since the society is run by big companies,
okay,
so for some reason the party is not an important configuration in Iranian understanding of what's going on here.
Yeah.
So they don't see it that way. So in that sense, maybe it's comparable, because in Iranian society, the party system is not that strong either.
Mm-hmm.
There are some, shall we say, interest groups of various kind working, but not formal party system.
Right. Is there ever any discussion of the incidents of demonstrations in the late 60s and 70s about Vietnam, about the rights of young people and counterculture and so on? Is that something that, given the importance of some of the demonstrations in Iran, a strong feeling about things, do they connect it at all with?
That's pretty touchy business now. When the perception, or the official perception, until 8 months ago, used to be Great Satan, Great Satan, Great Satan all the time.
So
you don't try to compare your demonstration with the demonstration done in the Great Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, things have changed a bit.
Mm-hmm. He thought that Nixon's fate in some ways was sealed by demonstrations. I mean, it wasn't the only thing. That Watergate was the cause of his death. Well, probably much more, but still the fact that he and Lyndon Johnson were the objects of demonstrations had a great deal to do with their popularity. And is that ever discussed in terms of what makes an American president successful or unsuccessful?
Well, the topic of why an American president is successful or not successful is talked about, is discussed sometimes here and there, but whether it's being linked with the popular politics, it's a different story. I think that requires some level of sophistication. But in time, I think it will hopefully come. But the impact of television is talked about a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, sometimes, for one reason or another, when let's say there is a program or a debate on television, an Iranian television, about something,
mm-hmm,
let's say communication, and then I have seen myself that the the impact of Iranian, the American television on American elections and so on is discussed a great deal, and of course I think given a, overrated,
mm-hmm.
but that is discussed a great deal. But I think that's a very important topic, that when you unleash the power of the masses,
mm-hmm.
What happens is it's really always always dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
May turn against you.
Mm-hmm.
One day maybe we start discussing that, because
mm-hmm.
but now it's not talked about, it's not discussed in great detail.
Is there much discussion of the American system and the First Amendment, freedom of speech and press and assembly?
It depends where you are talking about this. Sometimes they in classes, definitely,
mm-hmm.
people get, students in particular, get very, very interested.
Mm-hmm.
There you really have the role of this new elite, or like, shall we say, the new educated,
mm-hmm.
who talk about the American system. Well, let's say they preface or they immunize, if I use the word, themselves by starting with this: if you want to be somebody's enemy, you should know your enemy best.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, let's try to understand them rather than cursing them.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, you really, then you can get on with the business.
Right.
And then you say, listen, let's talk about the forefathers. These people are serious stuff. These Federalist Papers, you should take them just lightly. They're much more important than the American Constitution.
Uh-huh.
And there, maybe really, it's not because they don't want to understand it. There, maybe it's that effect of the French influence of legal approach to politics.
Mm-hmm.
Legalism of politics has a great deal to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
When you say, listen, the Federalist Paper is much more important than the Constitution itself. And they all get, what do you mean? Constitution is the law. Say, well, listen, the whole insight and nuances of the Constitution is there.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't understand that, what good does it do if you say checks and balances, separation of power, checks and balances? And that phrase doesn't mean a thing unless you read those.
Mm-hmm.
And read the fact that...
Federalist Paper.
The fact that in Federalist 10 you're talking about competition, part of human history and part of human life and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So one should be really fair to,
mm-hmm.
to let's say, Iranian elite and Iranian intellectuals, and saying they didn't pay attention to Federalist Paper not because they thought it's not important, just because this legalistic approach to politics is so powerful and so ingrained.
Mm-hmm.
That's why even the Department of Politics usually are in law school.
In the law school, yeah. Well, that's true, or was true anyway, throughout Europe, isn't it? Especially through
mm.
French-speaking countries and Germany as well. But after World War II, there were some changes in this regard. There's one hidden assumption that in this paper that I mentioned, and that is that the United States doesn't really understand much about Iran, but by implication, that although Iran may understand more about the United States, it has some vast areas of ignorance and misunderstanding. If you were to mention one or two misunderstandings about the American presidency that have political consequences, in your opinion, what would they be? Or you might even want to broaden it beyond the presidency.
Well, I'd...
For instance, just one thing that comes to anybody's mind is that was there a feeling at the time of the Shah that if there were strong demonstrations in the street, if there were protests, that immediately the president, being a king, or having some of the attributes of a king, would cut off support to the Shah, and that these demonstrations would have a direct political effect. Is that, are there things of that kind that are misunderstanding?
In fact, that's what I wanted to actually begin with. Let's say this heritage of royalist view of president.
Yeah.
Or that heritage of both heritage, whether it's a royalist view or whether it's a new left view, they see the president of the United States as a much more powerful man than he really is. In other words, they don't. Maybe I shouldn't use that, but they don't see him really as a juggler who has to juggle between various factions and various. Corner of the American society and government in order to come up with some sort of consensus building. So they don't see it that way. They see it as a much more royal, more one-man power, which can, in fact, order and get things get done. So I think that legacy is still there. That's one area. And the second area is that they don't simply understand that American society or American people, and in the same token, American president, is really tarnished between these ideals put forward by the forefathers and the national interest. And that is a messy business. Anybody wants to get into compromising the two or bridging the gap between the two. So therefore, sometimes they do not understand a certain thing that the American president does out of national interest, which may appear to contradictory to American ideals, or in fact maybe in reality contradicting some of the American ideals. And that furiates that they see it as a hypocrisy. Why should an American president say this and act the other? And so, and there may be something has to do with not understanding the international system and as it is operated by national interests rather than ideals and so forth. So that those are, I think, the two main areas that I would see.
On the first of those two, is the fact that. For instance, if I understand it, that Rafsanjani has had to deal with contending elements, both direct opponents, but also just the group in the legislative system. Is that likely to help Iranians understand that there is a Congress with which the president has to contend?
Well, it's interesting that you're just following my mind, because of course you have been my teacher. Let's see. That's what I was following up my comment with, that I was going to follow up my comment by saying that this democratization of Iranian politics, which the way of seeing it may be in minority, but I genuinely believe that there is a democratization of Iranian politics taking place very gradually. And Rafsanjani seems to be the type of person who doesn't want to eliminate one faction. Because of this past legacy of kingship, he could easily eliminate one faction, and I think nothing would happen. But he seems to be a man of really collectivity, and he wants to build up some sort of coalition before he makes a decision. Now, this painful process of diffusing one faction without eliminating them and helping them help him to shape a more consensus may in fact help in formulation of a more sophisticated approach to politics. Now there you can talk about the misunderstanding of this side. Now this side, having the perception that in Iran the king orders and others follow, or let's just be very frank about it and say the imam orders and others follow, do not understand that the age of king and imam has passed. Now here is an ordinary man who has to juggle and who has to come up with some sort of sophistication. That's why here they say, if they help free the hostages, we'll do this. But he can't. He has to build up a coalition even before he starts really influencing people in Lebanon. Because even if we assume that people in Lebanon are directly related to Iran, they're not going to follow the order from Tehran. And poor Rafsanjani has always said that. I promise I will do my best to influence them. And he's really telling the truth. He's not being modest about his power and so forth. Because I honestly believe that the age of Imam and the Shah has passed. The Shah will give order and the Imam will give decrees.
Will that make for greater or less instability in the future?
Well, it all depends how shrewd he is to handle the problem, and how I think understanding the outside world is to understand what's going on. This is one corner that the outside world is very ignorant about the internal development. All the indications are that it's really moving toward stabilization rather than the other way around.
Do you think that there's more ignorance of American politics in Iran, or more ignorance of Iranian politics in the United States? How would you compare those two?
Well, if you want to really take both of them as a face value, they are equal. If you want to be very picky and let's say very minute, there is more here. The reason being, Iranians do not have the same kind of let's say means which exist here. Iranians do not have the same kind of availability of funds or expertise or whatever they want to that exists here. With all these availability, all these things, it's really pity that this side doesn't understand the other side. I also feel that we are not talking about two equals. We are not talking about two equals. We are talking about a great power as opposed to a rising power, shall we say, a small nation. Which no doubt has a great past and all the rest of it, but at this minute it's not a great power. So therefore it is, as Reinhold Niebuhr always used to emphasize, Americans should be ready to take responsibility for the amount of power they have. Now, considering the amount of power the Americans have and considering the role they can play in world politics, it's really their responsibility to be understanding far more than the other way around.
Right.
Sometimes when I hear the Americans saying that we leave UNESCO or we leave that organization or we do this, it's really so astonishing. It's like a little child to say, no, I don't like it, so I leave.
Take my toys.
You take my toys and I leave the room.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be there. It's your responsibility. Shouldn't have become a great power. Pack and go home.
Yeah.
But don't say I'm a great power then.
But again, to ask about the analogies, to what extent can Iranians understand the fact that decisions like that are driven very frequently by domestic politics, that an administration that takes the United States out of UNESCO gains a great deal of political credence with the center and the right in this country, just as presumably Rafsanjani maybe doesn't do away with the opposition, partly because this is a means of augmenting his political power.
Exactly. Now they have this democratization of politics. I think this is the dilemma of democracy, I guess, which they are beginning to face right now. And it's really hard to do. But on the other hand, you can't have it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Then why do you want to have the leadership of the world, if that's the kind of game you want to play?
Yeah.
If you want to worry about the old woman in the far corner of your neighborhood, then don't try to play game with the greatest statesman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Go and open up a nursery or something. Yeah.
Farhan, we've mentioned legalism, but we haven't mentioned law or a third branch of government or the judiciary. Is the fact that, as you pointed out in your book on Khomeini, that law and morality, as I understand it, come from and are identical with law, politics, morality in a different way than they are. You spoke a moment ago also about having to spend a lot more time on religion and politics in Iran. Is there any judicial check of any kind on the independence of the executive or the legislature?
Oh yes, there are. It's really amazing, and we were talking, I think it was yesterday, you mentioned that there is an interest here about looking at to the effect of the American Constitution on other society.
Yeah.
To me, the revision which was happened on the Constitution about maybe 8 months ago, 9 months ago in Iran, made it look more like an American presidential system than a European parliamentary system. So the judiciary branch of the government has certain prerogatives in some senses to check on the decisions of the executive. For example, there is this judiciary review in the U.S. done by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Judiciary review, which is really a judiciary review, is done by a group of judges and jurisconsults, who are, officially speaking, seems to be part of the legislative body, but in practice they are really judiciary, because anything the president signs or any law that he, the president as the head of the executive branch, presents to the parliament, they have to check it and go through it and say whether it is contradictory in terms of the Constitution, in terms of the Islamic law, and as they say, in terms of law of nature and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that kind of judiciary review, which is almost like the judiciary review here. But it's far, their power is far broader than the Supreme Court in the U.S. Because not only they check the president and the executive, they check everybody.
Mm.
Any decision in the country should be checked and reviewed by them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way of...
Because of this identity of politics and law and morality?
Both because of that, and also because maybe the Constitution of the U.S. has been studied by some people who are reviewing or thinking about it.
Is there some fairly clear evidence that people who have introduced this particular change have studied and adapted the U.S. Constitution?
Really say that. I cannot say that.
Is some of it more than an influence of the American Constitution? Does it stem from Islamic law and indigenous ideas of justice?
Well, I think looking at its form, it may have been affected by American political system, not the Constitution, but the system as presents itself to the world, as projects itself to the world through the mass media and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, on the religious level, because this identity of politics, law, and religion,
mm-hmm.
and of course Islamic religion being more juridical,
mm-hmm.
in its meaning,
mm-hmm.
and then it stems from that no game or no politics or no game in general, whether it's legal, whether it's political, whether it's social, whether it's cultural, should be played on the framework set by the Islamic precepts.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, there must be somebody who be in charge of this, and who is the qualified people, the jurisconsult, those who
mm-hmm.
know the Islamic law very well.
Mm-hmm.
But then they have added a few lay lawyers,
mm.
the jurists who have studied law in even foreign schools and foreign universities and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So this 12-member body called the Council of Guardian, the title
mm.
of it is interesting. Mm. Custodians, the mm. Council of Custodians, I guess, is a better translation for it. This 12-member body is six with is jurist, religious jurist, theologian, and jurist who know theology, who know religious law, and then six of them are lay lawyers and judges who know the international law, who know Napoleonic code, who know foreign legal systems and so forth.
Mm-hmm. How would you, in terms of any kind of constitutional influence or broader political influence, how would you compare today as contrasted with 19th century or first half of the 20th century, the relative influence of French constitutional thought and the American? Has
well,
there been any change?
We got our first constitution in 1905, mm-hmm. and it's relatively known that it basically was an imitation of the European, particularly the French-speaking people. In fact, our legal code, the criminal code, was a straightforward Napoleonic code, which was mm-hmm. translated. Now, of course, gradually, as we move forward toward the 20th century, the more we come forward, the more the government and the society and the governance of the society is shaped after other regions, mm-hmm. some Great Britain, and more and more American. Mm-hmm. And the constitution in the new constitution drawn up after the revolution in 1979, there are French-educated individuals in the council and the group, but there are a lot of non-French and English and American educated people there, so they must have something to do with it. They might have had something to do with it.
Is the curriculum in the law faculty separable and definable in this way? The French, do they study comparative law in the law faculty?
Sometimes they do. Some professors teach comparative. Mm-hmm. But since the law system in the United States is case by case method,
common law
and case method.
Case method.
And in Iran, it's still Napoleonic. Mm-hmm. So the professors at law school are usually, and mostly, actually from Europe, mm-hmm. basically from French-speaking societies. It is more and more in political field, in the area of political science, that people mm-hmm. usually come from the U.S. So.
Tell me if this is the wrong summary, then, that there has gradually been an infusion of some ideas about the American political system, but that there is also a residue of influence of French thought.
Yes, there is a residue of the French system, but it's an irony of history that the majority of the elite of the Islamic Republic are American educated.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what kind of irony it is, but it's an irony.
Yeah, yeah.
And this America being great Satan is really strange. I guess in Iran today, who are the most important people? I shouldn't say important people, I say where are the most important institutions?
Mm-hmm.
The president, of course, and I guess the chief justice. But more important than all of them, the Minister of Petroleum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because after all, that's where the money and the bread and butter comes.
Yeah.
The Minister of Petroleum is an American educated gentleman for about 10 years now.
Right.
And even in the new change of the cabinet, stayed put.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know, what does he say? What does it mean? But it may mean something.
Yeah. Yeah.
That has... And even the foreign minister was mm-hmm. although he's a medical doctor, but he got a lot of training here.
As you know, one of the most hotly contested and debated issues in this country in connection with the human rights issue had to do with Islamic practices and practices in Middle Eastern countries involving the punishment of wrongdoers of various kinds, cutting off their hands, burying people and punishing them in that way. And very often when American and British legal scholars discuss the limitations of human rights, they would draw an example from Middle East culture. To what extent is there any softening, if there is any, of some of the harsher aspects of punishment and in response to crime as a result of U.S. influence, constitutional influence?
I don't think it's really the influence of the other side. It's rather having more sophisticated view of things. Mm-hmm. In other words, before the revolution, or let's say in Iranian case, or even for that matter you can say in Islamic case, religious jurist sitting in the corner of their office, never having to face real life issues, would hypothetically say, if such and such committed such and such crime, and then he should be, his hands should be cut off. Fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, but now facing real issues, they have to, they do not compromise the principle. But then they see a lot of factors that they didn't use to see.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it says, if a man steals somebody else's thing, then he should be punished for it. And the punishment is to cut the finger by which he has picked up somebody else's property.
Possession
and property, or whatever, article of possession. Now, in principle, I think it's absolutely, in their mind, justified to do that,
mm-hmm.
just the same way as, let's say, national interest is the prime, judge in the West.
Mm-hmm.
You forgive anything, but not the one who has compromised the national interest.
Mm-hmm.
He's put to death for treason and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you compromise that? Not at all. Now, an Islamic state, the reason of a state is not so much the national interest, is that Islamic principles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you compromise those principles, you are really in practice are compromising the reason of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So they really cannot compromise.
Mm-hmm.
What the story is this. Now that, let's say, they want to put Islam into real practice,
mm-hmm.
they have come up to the realization that it's not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
The man who has picked up the article of possession is hungry. What do you expect him to do? Die?
Mm-hmm.
So they, in other words, they have come to juggle. They have, there they were juggling with one ball. They throw it out and they hold it with the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, if you don't bring out your hand, the ball will fall down.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple. One clear-cut example. If somebody picked up somebody's article of possession, his finger should be cut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they are given five balls and say, juggle.
Mm-hmm.
And said, well, it is true that he picked up the article of possession, but his stomach was empty. He has five children to feed.
Yeah.
Well, what can he do?
Mm-hmm.
See, these are the this kind of analysis. Even in the case of stoning somebody who has committed adultery.
Right. Yeah.
Fine. If somebody committed adultery nowadays, they say, listen, the poor family, the poor woman, this child is sick, it doesn't have any money to take him to doctor, so think about it. Ask why she is doing what she is doing. So in other words, in real life, they are coming to the realization that in reality, it is not as simple as saying, if this happened, we do that.
Right.
That if has all kinds of branches going from all different directions. The I has many branches, the F has many branches, so if is not just one direction, if is taking him to a various opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
So he's thinking twice.
Yeah.
He's thinking three times, four times, five times, which let's say in his seminary he didn't have to think that at all.
Yeah.
Even in the case of somebody, even like Khomeini, for example. He had to think seriously about these things. It's not that simple.
No. You, in those examples you gave, you were talking mainly about circumstances. What were the conditions for the woman? What was the condition for the man who was hungry? But what about laws of evidence and proof? We have a case going on right now where we even summon the President of the United States to do a tape because you want evidence, if you can, in the trial of National Security Advisor Poindexter, and you summon Mr. North to come back. But what about the introduction of stronger requirements about evidence we had in Islamic law?
Exactly. That's the case. But you see, it depends on the individual. Mm-hmm. I have as apprentice of law. Mm-hmm. I go to court, and it's really enormous to see both judges, who are of course wearing turban and they are religious jurists as well.
Yeah.
It's enormous that the first one I have observed and said, well, listen, it's fine. Are you sure you saw that crime be committed? Mm-hmm. Yes, I see. Well, why don't you go home and relax and come back 2 days later?
Mm.
Or maybe today you are now influenced by, well, he really debates whether he should accept his evidence. Wrong. On the other hand, I have seen judges who just say, yeah, you saw that, fine, okay, that's one.
Huh.
And the other one. It really depends on the individual. The Islamic law seems to be so really a matter of interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's take the case of the extreme case of, let's say, that a Muslim man can marry 5, 6, 4, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It is true, it is explicit that you are given the privilege of marrying more than one woman.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the sentence. You can marry more than one woman provided you treat them justly.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's all right there.
Yeah.
Now if there is a judge which says, oh well, some countries say, who can decide whether I can treat justly or not? A third disinterested judge. So they let the judge to be the person who will decide whether you can marry or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now the judge says, I don't believe you can treat two people justly. And
for
that's the end of it.
For economic and other reasons.
For all kinds of reasons. Suppose the man is a sophisticated person and who has, God has put in his head some of the complexity of Reinhold Niebuhr, for example. Mm-hmm. He would never believe that a man can treat two people equally.
Right.
So therefore he says, don't come to me, I do not give anybody permission.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the other hand, you get somebody who says, no, I can treat justly. It's really all matter of taking the Islamic principles seriously and trying to honestly put them into practice.
Mm-hmm. You don't think that what some of these problems and complexities have done have been to shatter the applicability of some principles. We had a speaker here from another Islamic country, and he said that in effect the rules having to do with adultery were so difficult to establish. I mean, somebody must witness the act. Well, under close cross-examination, it turns out persons cannot have witnessed the act. And so the punishment that Westerners talk about for stoning people, executing people for adultery, in effect is almost never employed.
Exactly. Sure.
Is that true in Iran too?
Well, but the point is that it's not that never it's employed, let's call it postponed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's give the case that can be said. Yes, in Iran there are many issues which is almost like that.
Mm-hmm.
Say, how could you do that? In fact, there are people who sarcastically say that the leaders or the saints of Islam wanted that the adultery never be punished, because why would somebody commit adultery in front of a four witness?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sarcastically, they say it was meant that we shouldn't just talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's happened, let's just be discreet. Yeah. Human beings are like that, they do it, so let them do it. But let's take the example of, for example, initiating war.
Yeah.
In Shiism, for example. They said, nobody knows whether which side is just. So unless the man be infallible, and the infallibles are just saints sent by God, while they are not present, no war should be initiated. Defensive war is accepted, but not aggressive. So in a way you can say that according to the Shi'i principles, they can never go to war. In fact, they have a law which prohibits war in an indirect way. Mm-hmm. Well, you could say that. Mm-hmm. But to me, it is not really compromising their principles. It is just realizing the fact that certain things are just needs to have a different condition. Mm-hmm. But for that, you have to grant them the fact that for them, the other world is the same as here. Right. Except there are different phases. Mm-hmm. See, what Machiavelli has done for us has made the whole world temporal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the post-Machiavellian mind, when you talk about the other world, you are really, in fact, compromising your principles.
Yeah.
But for him, it's not. He's not compromising his principles because he believes that one day a Jesus or a 12th Imam or a Muhammad will come back mm-hmm. and continue what is left. Yeah. And therefore those punishment and those kind of principles could in fact put into practice.
Yeah. What percentage of the Iranian people believe in that idea, that concept, the second coming or any
well, the
life hereafter?
Officially they say it's 99% of Shia Muslims, but the return of the religion in the world in general, the resurgence of religion tells me that people are tired of temporal world of Machiavelli and they are going back to it, whether they are Iranians or whether American or whether mm-hmm. Israeli or whether whatever. So it's
but here, for instance, the religious revival has tended to come mainly from marginal groups, what's called non-mainstream groups, fundamentalist groups and so on. Is the same true?
We can say that non-marginal group because they are not effective in politics.
Yeah.
But if you really ask the heart of the people, I think they are the majority. But what happens is that at the same time, they believe that religion has its proper place to proper place, and politics is proper place, and therefore they don't seem to be vocal about it.
Yeah. But here it's the opposite, that Jerry Falwell believes that religion really ought to substitute for politics. In a curious way, it's almost a identity with your basic idea.
Yes, exactly. In other words, what I'm saying is that it is true on one level of analysis mm-hmm. that saying that, or the colleagues or the fellow Muslim who was here and talked to you about this, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. In one level of analysis, it is in fact giving up the principles. Mm-hmm. But all I'm saying is that I'm taking you a more deeper level and say, in a deeper level, he's not compromising it, he's just postponing it, because he believes that world is as true as this one.
Yeah.
But it's not just the time.
Yeah.
All you, let's say, you tell me, listen, I know that you like to go out and play baseball, but you shouldn't do it because now you have to study and go and take your comprehensive exam.
Yeah.
So I know that the time comes when I can play baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So both worlds are true for me. I'm not compromising the principle of not playing baseball by sitting down in the room and reading for my comprehensive.
Yeah.
Because I know down the road I can go out. Mm-hmm. So for him, the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All I'm trying to do is just trying to take us to a deeper level of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But on the surface, sure, it seems that he's giving up his principle for a vague future which you might say, I know it's not going to come. But for him, it is reality.
I don't know how much time you think we have left. Is it still going? Do you?
I think so.
Yeah, good. There is one, we've really in the last 30 minutes been talking about a second subject, and I've deliberately tried to keep it on that because we almost have two very interesting presentations here, one on constitutionalism and the other on the presidency. But on this constitutionalism system, it used to say that people used to be said, people adopted the Roman law because they got benefits from it. They got security, for one thing. They got became Roman citizens, mm-hmm. or at least impartial Roman citizens. There'd been a bad period in Iranian-U.S. relations in recent years. Now it looks as though it may be changing somewhat. But has American constitutional influence dropped off in Iran in the last 10 or 15 years because of the difficulties in the relationship, beginning with the hostages, beginning with, is there less willingness to think seriously about any kind of American constitutional ideas because the political relations have been bad?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's I think the response or the answer to the question came in the very last few sentences that you mentioned, namely the grudges have never been on principles. Mm-hmm. The grudges have been on historical fights. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. See, it's almost like two neighbors who both know that they have something to offer to each other, but because the son of one broke the window of the other, they fight with one another, but they are not really dismissing each other. There is an interesting distinction which is made on the level of even the officials in Iran. Namely, we have problem, we have difficulty, we have disagreement with American government, mm. not with American people. Mm. I think that distinction should be taken seriously on the level of reconstructing the relationship, which I don't think may come within the next 10, 15 years. It may, I don't know when it will come, God knows. Mm-hmm. But the point is that people tend to give away a lot of things, even in the casual conversation, but we tend not to hear them. Mm-hmm. Now here is one. In other words, nobody says Americans are bad. Mm-hmm. Nobody says they don't have a great deal to contribute. Nobody says they are not advanced. Nobody says they are not the most powerful country. All they say is that we have difficulties. Mm-hmm. These bad boys in American government are doing this nasty thing. Mm-hmm. They go to El Salvador, or they go to Vietnam, or they come here and have coup d'etat. There's nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. So that I think on the surface fighting on the private having a great deal of respect is there. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, in fact, the influence has gone away mm-hmm. during the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's funny, in fact, that there is none of those former hostages are here to testify to that. But I had a student one time, he just came to me one day and said, you know, for 444 days I was a guard of an American. I said, oh, well, tell me about it. He said, we became such a good friend. Mm. He knew Persian and he knew Iranian history. When we talked, I learned a great deal from him. Mm. Well, what kind of strange. Nobody would believe me if I say that on television. They make fun of me if I say that, but it's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now somebody should go and ask these people, these 50-odd people, and say, well, tell us about them, you know, on the personal level. Forget about all these nasty fights at the official level. Tell us about it. What happened?
Yeah. Do you think the media is a prime obstacle to that? It may go both ways, because the media also, for instance, at the time of the TWA capture, why some of the hostages said just what you said. They became good friends of the people who were their captives. But others, of course, were bitter to the end. But the media keeps playing up some of these differences sometimes. And one time the Chinese are public enemy number one in the United States. Another time the Soviets. Right now, If you look at the polls, as you probably know, Iranians are public enemy number one
in the
polls.
Well, they do their jobs. See, that's the unfortunate part, that the newspaper, the media, is a business, unfortunately. It's not a public forum. And therefore, it's not their fault. They have to make their commodity look very attractive. And the grossest the story, the more customer it has. I never forget that at one time, we were in Washington, the American Press Club or something. Mm-hmm. There was National Press Club, somebody was giving a lecture, and I was an audience sitting there and listening. It was interesting. He said, when I went just started my job as a newspaper person, newspaper man, and the first job I had, I went to this editor and said, I'm applying for a job. He said, here, there's a notepad and a letter. You go, you're going to set up a new airport in the neighborhood. Go and ask the neighborhood what they think. So we said, fine. So I went back and knocked at the first door and I said, there's going to be a new airport, what do you think? And the person said, well, fine, and so forth. And I wrote a story based on what I heard. So I came and gave it to the editor. He looked at it and said, boring, what is this nonsense? Don't you know how to ask questions? Well, I asked no questions. That's not the way to ask questions. You go to the first door. First of all, you do some study. Mm-hmm. And the first door have a 6 months old baby. You knock at the door and ask the lady, do you know they are going to set up an airport here? She says, yes. Say, do you know from now on at midnight, at 2 o'clock in the morning, the plane is going to land and go up and say, psh, and down and so on and wake up your baby? Now what do you think? I really never forget that story. And because of that, I never talk to any newspaper person. Never.